You're listening to First Point Japan's Spotlight Series, where we interview the people and analyze the things that matter for you to establish, build out, and accelerate your Japan business. Only at firstpointjapan.com, where Japanese business begins. And now, here's your host, James Santagata.
Tonight's segment, we have with us Damien Wei. He is the founder and managing director of Legal Futures, which is a Japan-based executive search firm for attorneys and legal help in Japan. How are you doing tonight, Damien?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Very good, thanks. And tonight we'd like to learn a bit about some of the dynamics and the environment in the not only for recruiting of attorneys in Japan, but also some of the trends and some of the differences between perhaps the market and demand for legal services in Japan versus what we might find in North America or the UK or continental Europe as well. Okay. Damien, could you perhaps give us a little of your background or how you got into this particular field?
Sure. So I'm a UK trained lawyer. I trained with a British law firm called Allen & Overy back in 1996. I trained with them in London and then got transferred to the Hong Kong office, and then from there got transferred to the Tokyo office. I was what they call a capital markets lawyer, so stock exchange type products, bonds, derivatives. I did that for 4 years, and to be honest, much as I had enormous respect for lawyers, I didn't really see myself doing it long term. So the opportunity arose to actually set up a legal recruitment business. We set up in Hong Kong and Tokyo at the same time. And I ran the Tokyo office, and I've run the Tokyo office for the last 13 years. So it sort of started out as a business sort of by lawyers, for lawyers. We started working with law firms and the investment banking sector and also the corporate sector. And yet, 13 years down the line, we're still doing the same thing.
Well, that's great, great. So obviously you must have seen a lot of changes, not only through the two different, I'd say the dot-com bubble and perhaps the financial restructuring and change back in the 2008 period as well. One of the things that kind of struck me and one of the other persons I was talking about is, you know, coming from the U.S. or North America, we have, a huge amount of attorneys. In fact, I was looking it up just recently, and it was over 1.2 million active attorneys in the U.S. And looking in a similar period, this was according to the American Bar Association. According to the Japan Bar Association, there was about 30,000 registered attorneys in Japan during that same time period. It seems like such a mismatch. Do you have any insights into why that might be or some of the dynamics of the market?
Well, there's an old joke that in New York, you can always find a lawyer, but you can never find a taxi. And the reverse is true in Japan. Yeah. So it's for the size of the economy, it's a tiny, tiny world here for lawyers. There are very few bengoshi, and there are even fewer foreign lawyers here. And there's some history there. It used to be incredibly hard to actually pass the Japanese bar. The failure rate was sort of 97%. Wow. And I don't know whether it's the same in the States. It's not the same in the UK, but there are people who will take the Japanese bar 8, 9, 10 times, and they will keep failing. And I think I think now they've put a limit on. I think if you fail it 10 times, you can't take it ever again.
I see.
So, that historically it was actually just very hard to be a bengoshi. So, there weren't many of them. And then Japan tried to adopt a little bit of what you have in the US. They try to make it easier for bengoshi to be created, because there was always this feeling that, for an economy this size, there should be more lawyers here. So to solve that problem, they try to make it easier to pass the bar and also to sort of create more law schools. And it's it's kind of backfired, because the reality is the reason there are so many lawyers in the UK and so many lawyers in the US is because you have so many law firms there. And, you know, I know for myself, when I was training in London, the only way you become a lawyer is, you know, you need to be trained. You need to work for senior lawyers who can teach you your trade. You know, what you learn at school, it's, you know, it's minor stuff. Until you actually do it, you know, you're not a lawyer. And the problem for Japan is there aren't that many large Japanese law firms here. You know, there aren't that many. So even though the old system where you only had 3,000 mengoshi, it didn't seem such a high number. At least they were all going through a good, thorough training system at a good Japanese firm. What's now happening is they'll maybe turn out 1,000 or 1,500 bengoshi a year, but there's no way the system can absorb that many lawyers to train. So what they tried to do was create a system whereby more lawyers would be created, but they don't have the infrastructure to actually train and create them. Therefore, people were saying, well, you complain that there weren't enough lawyers in Japan. We've now given you more, and you've not given jobs to any of them. So it's kind of backfired. It wasn't really thought through. So you've still end up with the same situation where you now have, you know, you still only have 3,000 lawyers here, but you now have lots and lots of unemployed people.
I see.
Because there are no jobs for them. So it was kind of an odd system. So although it's still an under-lawyered market, I don't see it changing anytime soon, because, you know, there's no structure to train all these people they're putting through. Now on the foreign side, you know, the foreign lawyers here are, you know, what they call gaiben, sort of registered foreign lawyers. Most of them working at, of course, the foreign law firms here and the foreign companies. But, you know, as you know yourself, there are only, what is it, 2,000 foreigners in Tokyo, was it? Is it that few?
I've heard something like that.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a tiny, tiny portion of those foreigners are lawyers. So, yeah, long story short, there aren't many lawyers here.
Interesting. Now, the other question would be, I guess, is within that, and there's some other things I wanted to ask you, What percentage do you think are bilingual, whether it's in English or another language? Is it a very small percentage of that, or?
I mean, I think certainly on the bengoshi side, there are a number of, you know, very distinguished and well-known bengoshi who are perfectly bilingual, but, you know, the majority aren't. On the foreign side, sort of same story applies. The reality is most of the work the foreign lawyers do here, it's not always dependent on them actually speaking Japanese. Sometimes it is, but not always. So I would say true bilingual either side is a relatively small portion, maybe 30%. Most lawyers here will have, you know, some Japanese ability, and there will be many. You know, when I was a lawyer here, I didn't speak a word of Japanese and still don't, unfortunately. So you know, it's not a prerequisite to be in this market to speak Japanese, but increasingly it's becoming more important, just because there are so few positions for lawyers in Tokyo that they can be picky. Basically, they can be picky for the right experience, the right language ability. So it certainly helps. If you want to practice law in Japan as a foreigner, speaking Japanese will certainly help.
I see. Interesting. Great. And I guess the other question may be, I would imagine there's probably several different markets for these attorneys. So also, Damien, within the market for these lawyers, I would imagine there's a couple. Are you mostly recruiting for the foreign firms, the Gaishke, or are you doing domestic as well?
We pretty much only focus on foreign law firms here.
Okay, great. Now, within that market too, I imagine there's probably some segments. Are these like corporate in-house counsel or for financial institutions, or what type of positions do you see, or what how's the market for that?
I mean, most of the foreign law firms here are either headquartered out of London or New York, and they do what we call big ticket transactions. It's big ticket financings, by which I mean IPOs, large mergers and acquisitions, large project finance, sort of infrastructure type deals. Basically, they're the sorts of transactions that you need to throw a lot of lawyers at, and therefore you have a good you know, have a good margin. You know, of course, law firms are businesses like everything else, and it's an expensive place to do business. Lawyers are very well paid here. So, you know, the law firms tend to focus on large finance-based transactions, whether that's a banking transaction or a project finance transaction or a sort of corporate M&A type transaction. And, mm-hmm. And all of the firms you have here pretty much focus on those areas. There are a few other things. Intellectual property is a growth area, predominantly trademark protection. Mm-hmm. You also have some growing litigation stroke ADR, alternative dispute resolution practices. But outside of those sort of core areas, the foreign law firms here don't really do anything else. They just focus in that fairly limited but lucrative area.
I see. Actually, going back to litigation, so in your mind, are there litigators in demand, or is it mostly the ADR you mentioned, or how do you see any trends or focus on it? It's interesting.
I mean, the reality of what you have here is, of course, you have both large Japanese companies with major international businesses, or you have major foreign businesses who have large Japanese offices, large Japanese business. So most of what you have on the litigation side is either, you know, your client here is a big Japanese company who is being sued in the US, but of mm-hmm. course the US office doesn't speak Japanese. So the Japanese office will have Japanese lawyers, often Bengoshi, who will be talking to your client here in Japan, then liaising with their colleagues in San Francisco or New York, where they're actually being sued, and vice versa. All of the sort of, or a lot of the domestic litigation, Japanese companies suing Japanese companies, will be done by the Japanese law firms generally. Mm-hmm. So the litigation practices here are sort of outbound in the sense that it's liaising with outside offices because they're being sued in outside locations.
I see.
And I don't know if this is still the case, but there always used to be a mention that it would on average take 13 years for your average Japanese trial from beginning to end. Wow. You're looking at 13 years from, you know, the day you get served yeah. papers to the day you get your resolution or not. And, you know, frankly, who has 13 years, right? So
right.
ADR, alternative dispute resolution, it's becoming a hot area. You basically say, well, look, instead of going to trial, we're going to go and sit before what they call an accredited arbitrator and make it binding. It's kind of like, you know, a divorce. You know, you go to sort of marriage guidance and you sit there and you talk through your troubles, and a mediator says, okay, you know, maybe you should kiss and make up. It's kind of like that. It's saying, look, you know, we haven't got 13 years. We haven't got the millions of yen it's going to take to litigate this. Let's just sit around a table and sort this problem out. And you know, it's becoming increasingly a busy area. And mm-hmm. the foreign law firms here that do focus on litigation ADR, you know, they're busy. It's a good area to be in, but not many of the law firms here do it. Only a very niche number of law firms actually have a litigation ADR practice.
I see. Very interesting. Now, I guess another thing I'd bring up too is, you know, if we're talking about maybe the black letter law or some direct application, how are people finding some of the Japanese lawyers, maybe in what we'd see in the West, what we'd call creative problem solving, or maybe coloring outside the lines to find a resolution to something that may not be clear? Is there issues with that, or how is the flexibility?
I mean, there's I got to be careful what I say here, because I represent a number of Bengoshi, but there is a general perception from foreign clients, i.e. the general counsel working at an American company based in Tokyo, that Bengoshi Japanese lawyers are not that creative. But, you know, the reality is, you know, Japan, it's a civil law system. Are you familiar with civil law and common law?
No, just a little bit. Could you maybe describe that for us?
Okay, then? So basically, yeah. the sort of European location, you know, Germany, France, and also Japan, are what you call civil law. Basically, you have you have a book of legislation which tells you how things happen, you know, when you want to set up a company, when you want to get married, when you want to work out whether something's tax deductible. You know, you go to a big book and you go to page 400 and it will say, okay, it's either this or it's this. It's either A or it's B. Mm. Now, if you're a general counsel at a company and you've got, you know, 500 million yen riding on whether something is A or B, if your lawyer says, okay, well, I've looked at the code and the answer is A, and he'll say, well, I need the answer to be B. We've got 500 million riding on this. What can you do? And the Bengashi will say, well, the answer is A. So what you get from that is this sort of feeling that, you know, Bengashi are not creative, but, you know, their system doesn't allow them. If you look at the alternative, which is common law, okay, which be what you have in actually most countries in the UK and Australia and New Zealand, all the sort of Commonwealth countries, basically common law, you still have a book of laws and regulations, but whenever a matter comes up for discussion and it goes to trial, you have a judge who will say, well, I've looked at the legislation, and although I think A is one option, I can see how you can get to B, because these situation or this set of situation mean that actually maybe it was a B. And in that way, they sort of say that a common law system is the law living and breathing. It doesn't stay the same. It's always changing. And the next time that same point goes before a judge, he may say, actually, the judge that said this before, I disagree with him. I'm going to overturn it. So common law systems, they continue to grow and develop and live and breathe. But you don't have that in a civil law system. So
I see.
So yeah, so you do hear this complaint that Bengashi are not creative. They're not, that they can't give you the right answer, but you know, sometimes there isn't the right answer. The answer is it's A, and that is the answer.
I see. No, that's very interesting too. Another question too, I was wondering with, and I don't know how this affects it, but with we see now a lot of Japanese firms also starting to kind of venture overseas again, right? The Grease or Rakuten. Is that opening up new opportunities or joint ventures, or do you see any impact in the need of Japanese firms as well to partner? What's happening in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the big, you know, all the big news at the moment, of course, on the back of the, you know, the strong yen and, you know, the shrinking Japanese population and all the doom and gloom about Fukushima, etc. You know, all of the forward-looking smart Japanese companies are putting vast amounts of money overseas, and for lawyers that's great. You have a thing which they call outbound M&A, which is basically where a Japanese company buys or merges or acquires an overseas company. So you sort of have this this sort of growth of the moment of Japanese companies trying to actually move most of their revenue base overseas. And the knock-on effect it's having for the law firms is that, you know, if you're an outbound M&A lawyer today, you're very busy. You've got more work than you can probably handle.
I see. Very interesting. Also, regarding the types of lawyers too, I was doing a little research before this and came across a couple of types. I guess we have the regular Bengoshi, which may be, I guess, what, admitted to one of the...
Yeah, Japanese bars.
Okay. And then Gai Ben is the foreign...
Yeah, foreign registered lawyer.
Okay, great. And then I guess there's a Zaidishi, which is a tax
lawyer. Attorney. Yeah.
Okay. Now, also, I guess there's some type of, I don't know if you call them certified, but kind of an offload where they're able, there's another group of people able to do filings, corporate filings, that type of thing. Is there another segment of help there?
You've got Shiho Shoshi and my pronunciation's terrible, Gyosei Shoshi, what they call scriveners or administrative lawyers, all of that filing, company filing, regulatory, all of the sort of, I guess, what you would call grunt work of being a company in Japan, all of that filing, it tends to be sort of farmed off to those Gyosei Shoshis or Shiho Shoshis. And
I see.
It is a qualification. I mean, you qualify to be that, and it's not anywhere as prestigious as being a Bengashi, because it's, frankly, it's easier to pass, and it's much harder to pass being a Bengashi. And but it's a sort of subset which has grown up in Japan of these sort of administrative lawyers, and there are, you know, their entire firm set up to just do this. And it's not to say these things aren't covered in other locations. It's just it's not a qualification as such. You don't have to take a qualification in New York or London to do this, whereas in Japan you actually do. So yeah, it's a subset. There's four or five levels to being a lawyer of some sort in Japan. And I think it is unique to Japan.
Yeah, and I guess, and of course, 30,000 lawyers compared to a million is still different. But I guess also this, maybe the numbers are misstated, because you've got this other segment of individuals which are certified doing some of the offloading. So it kind of multiplies maybe the productivity or the amount of legal coverage or help that an individual or company could get.
Yeah,
in Japan, then.
And often you'll find that, you know, shihoshoshis are hired in-house to cover that exact work. I mean, are you familiar with the term corporate secretarial?
No, I'm not. No.
So basically, if you're a big company, you've got lots of regulatory filings you have to do. You've got things like whenever you have a board meeting, you have to record minutes. And if you're a listed company, you have to have them, you know, registered with the relevant stock exchange, and all this sort of internal admin. Often you'll have a person inside, you know, a gyososhoshi or a shihoshoshi who will be doing that. So yeah, there you're right. There is a sort of subset of people doing legal like tasks in the corporate sector, also the banking sector.
Interesting. Also, I'm curious. Again, you don't have to share anything confidential or any names, but in your mind, what you've seen. Let's go look on the corporate side too, where maybe we have. I'm just throwing out names. You know, it could be consumer goods firm, fashion, tech. What about in-house counsel? How are they normally filling those positions, or who is filling those for some of the larger companies? You know, the Gaishke in Japan. How is that normally handled?
I mean, that market's changing. I mean, we set up, as I say, 13 years ago. So we've seen, to be honest, we've seen the number of foreigners in those types of roles dramatically shrink. It used to be back in the day that, you know, you would have an American lawyer would be general counsel for the Tokyo office of an American company. It kind of made sense, and they would have Japanese staff working for them, or they'd have a Japanese law firm working for them, and it all worked very well. But but over time, as the number of Japanese lawyers has increased, and as the sort of number of companies have increased, it's actually becoming a lot harder now to be a foreign general counsel in Tokyo. There aren't so many of them left.
I see.
And you know, in many ways it makes sense, of course. You know, you're in Japan, most of the documents you do are governed by Japanese law. You know, it's very rare for a foreigner to truly be able to draft contracts in Japanese. Mm-hmm. There are a few here who say they can do it, but most will say, look, I can do it, but it's not a good spend of my time, you know. Mm-hmm. Get someone to do it for me. So I think, you know, that the market, even though maybe Japan is becoming more internationalized in outlook, actually the in-house legal market here is becoming much more domestically focused, i.e. filling those roles with Japanese. So that's definitely a trend we're seeing. If you're a very, very experienced general counsel from America, if you have no Japan experience and you don't speak Japanese, you're actually going to struggle to get a job here.
Okay. Got it. So now, is there a career path? Also, I'm curious, in the corporate in-house counsel, I guess there's probably a few. So they're coming out of usually private practice?
Yeah.
Maybe deciding to go into the corporate?
Yeah.
Side,
I mean, there's an old rule of thumb. If you're you don't want to go in-house until you've got 3 or 4 years experience at a law firm. Companies will generally assume, you know, quite rightly, that unless you've had 3 or 4 years good training at a law firm, you're not, you know, you don't know enough to be given the responsibility of an in-house role. But, you know, from 3, 4, 5, 6 years onwards, it's very, very common for lawyers to leave their law firm, move in-house, and then stay within that sector. Once you've jumped from a law firm to in-house, whether in-house corporate or in-house bank, it's actually quite hard to jump back into a law firm, because, you know, end of the day, you know, you're still a lawyer, you're still looking at contracts, but you're on the other side of that contract. When you're a lawyer in a law firm, you are generating contracts. When you're a lawyer in-house, bit of a generalization, but often you're reviewing contracts drafted by your external law firm, or you're creating documents based on a similar document you did before. You know, if you're doing a sale and purchase agreement, or you're doing a services agreement, you know, it's pretty similar to the one you did before, more often than not. So once you've sort of jumped from a law firm to an in-house role, it is quite hard to go back. But frankly, you know, when people jump in-house, they do it because they don't want to be in a law firm anymore anyway. They don't want to go back.
Sure. Great. I guess also the other question I might ask is, what do you see as some of the challenges maybe, you know, coming up in the Japan legal market, maybe from the perspective of a foreign law firm either looking to, build out or sustain operations or even enter the market for the first time? Is there new challenges coming up that you see?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, if you look at, I mean, I say we've been doing this for a long time, 13 years, and the last, you know, the last year, to be honest, was quite a brutal one for the foreign law firms. There, I won't name names, but there are a number of high-profile downsizing of foreign law firms. Foreign law firms who had invested a lot of time and money, you know, 10 years plus, to build up a Bengoshi practice. I mean, if I step back, what if you're an international law firm, you want to be able to do one key thing. You want to be able to offer all relevant legal coverage from your office. And when I say relevant, I mean, if you are a Japanese law firm, you want to be able to have lawyers who work for you who are UK qualified and who are US qualified. So that whenever there's a transaction, you can offer US law advice, UK law advice, and Japanese law advice. Now, most of the foreign law firms went along that route. If you're a US law firm, you would already have UK lawyers and vice versa. If you're then in Japan, you also really need to have Japanese lawyers. Now, there are some fairly high-profile British and US law firms who decided not to go that route. They just said, look, we don't need Japanese capability, even though we're in Japan, because of the types of work we're doing, because it's governed by US law, we do not need to have Japanese lawyers working for us. Other law firms took a different view. They said, look, we're in Japan. If one of our clients comes to us, we can help them with whatever they need, Japanese law, UK law, US law. So we'll be full service. We'll cover them for whatever they need. And if you look at, you know, what's happened in the last year with some, say, some fairly high profile downsizing of foreign law firms, you know, it may have turned out to be the wrong strategy, not through anyone's fault, just because, you know, we had Lehman and we had Fukushima and the market's just not big enough to support that type of large law firm here, or it doesn't seem to have been able to. And there are, then there are some obvious exceptions. There are some very successful, well-established, long-established law firms here that cover everything. But most of those big firms are actually struggling a little bit, and it's kind of, you know, the Japanese law firms have had the market sewn up for such a long time that I don't know, there just doesn't seem to be enough work to allow all of them to keep the size they want to be, and I think it's quite surprising. You know, you look at the economy size here, and you know, there's a lot of money in Japan. You know it's a wealthy country, right? There's a lot of money here, there's a lot of successful businesses here, a lot of successful companies here, but it hasn't developed the type of economy that allows the big international law firms to really colonize this market like they have done with others. You know, if you if you look at the UK firms and the US firms, they did very, very well basically recreating their London or New York mothership and just basically exporting it to the world, setting it up in Hong Kong, Singapore, Beijing, São Paulo, and, you know, being really successful. But for Japan, they tried to do that same model of basically introducing their London office to Japan and trying to hire some Japanese lawyers, and it just didn't seem to work. The market just didn't seem to allow that type of structure to work here.
I see. Very interesting. Now, on the flip side, is there any things you see trending, whether it's the outbound M&A or financing you mentioned, other things where there may be some new opportunities coming up? For firms like maybe new holes in the market or underserved areas?
I mean, the stuff that's hot, outbound M&A is definitely hot. Project finance is definitely hot. Resources, you know, one of the hottest areas at the moment is Japanese companies investing heavily in Australia, mainly coal, oil and gas fields. So, you know, if you're a big Japanese trading company, you will have a very big operation in Perth. And there's a real boom time feel to that sort of resources sector. So if you're a resources lawyer, you're in demand. Outbound M&A, definitely in demand. Trademark, definitely. Litigation ADR, if you speak Japanese fluently, in demand. Capital markets, securities, not so good at the moment as you might expect. But yeah, they're the current trends.
I see. Interesting. Great. Okay, great. Actually, I guess we're going to wrap this up shortly. Is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation?
Well, I mean, if you're listening to this and you're a lawyer currently in Japan or thinking about coming to Japan, I would certainly be very happy to talk to you if I'm allowed to do an advert like that.
Sure, absolutely. And by the way, after the program, we'll have all of your contact information as well, so people can get to you.
Okay.
But just to wrap this up, Damien, we're talking to Damien Wei, the founder and managing director of Legal Futures in Japan. And we've been discussing some of the structure of the legal market, the differences between what we might see for legal services in both Japan versus out of Japan, and some of the trends and challenges that have happened in the last year and what may be some of the future opportunities as well. Damien, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for listening. This program has been a presentation of First Point Japan, where we interview the people and analyze the things that matter for you to establish, build out, and accelerate your Japan business. Only at firstpointjapan.com, where Japanese business begins.